history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there waiting to be told. Eye-opening stories, remarkable stories, inspiring stories. But the only way we get to hear them is if we ask a few questions and then take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Here in America and around the globe, we're all treading on uncertain ground in light of this coronavirus pandemic. It's interrupting life here in the U.S. to a degree that hasn't taken place since World War II. And along with that, of course, has come this new idea of social distancing that we're all trying to get used to. Since the men and women we hear from each week on Hometown Heroes are part of the highest risk age group, I'm not going to be visiting any nonagenarians until it's safe to do so. And it also means that the weekly Stories of Service class in Clovis, California won't be meeting for a while. The interview you're going to hear today was recorded in that class earlier this month. Since 2002, veterans have met every Monday morning at 9:30 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District, and with the patient encouragement of Janice Stevens, they've shared their military memories, which have even turned into multiple books. That class will resume meeting when it's safe to do so, so if you live in or around Clovis, California, I know they'd love to see you there. Often when I meet up with a veteran, there's nobody else in the room, and if there is, it's usually a spouse or a child or a close friend of the veteran. For today's conversation with 96-year-old Al Bloomer, he was surrounded by dozens of his fellow veterans spanning from World War II into more recent decades. And if you happen to hear an occasional echo effect, it's because our conversation was being piped through the speaker system so they could all get to know their friend Al a little better. I started out by asking him how long he'd been participating in that class.
Oh, many, many Mondays. I don't remember exactly when, but a lot of years. I sure enjoy it.
And I'm going to be taking you a lot further back because we're going to hear about World War II from beginning to end. You were in the Navy before Pearl Harbor happened, and through the finish line, the USS Enterprise, the most active ship in World War II in more major engagements than any other ship, the legendary Big E is the ship that Al served on. But I want to take you further back. Before you got on the Big E, tell me about your childhood. Where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
I was born in Pennsylvania. And my dad, when I was about 4 years old, he decided he wanted to go to Alaska. Well, we got on a train, and as far as we got is California. I guess we ran out of money, and we settled in Dinuba, California. And that's where we was raised. I went to school there in Dinuba, from grammar school and so forth up into high school.
I wonder if you're the only family that's ever ended up in Dinuba trying to go from Pennsylvania to Alaska. I don't think that was the plan.
Yeah, but anyway, that's what happened. I have three sisters and two brothers. We are all together for a long time.
And today, you know, kids have a pretty different existence than I imagine you had back then in the 1920s and 30s. What can you tell us about your childhood, the things you had to do, what life was like?
One thing, when we lived out on the ranch there, I think it was in the fourth grade, and every year my dad would raise two pigs for butchering. And my job was to feed them in the morning and feed them at night. And I tell you, you better do it or you're going to be in trouble. But that's what it took. And then I used to ride the bicycle to the downtown where I went to school. So it was about 4 miles that I rode every morning and back. We didn't have buses in those days. We either walk or you rode your bike. And that was it.
And where did you fit into that birth order with your siblings?
I was the second one. I had a sister older than me. Yeah, she's still alive.
Still alive, older than you.
Yeah, she's a year and a half older than I am. She's 98.
Outstanding. So as the oldest boy, I'm sure you got the toughest jobs, right?
Well, yeah.
Like feeding the pigs.
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of other things, too. But when we lived on the farm, we used to have to pick grapes and help with that and then to make extra money. And believe it or not, I had to go out and pick up figs and put them in those 50-pound box. I think we got about the dime or 15 cents a box at that time. course, you know, that was a lot of money, too. And I usually always had to buy my own school clothes. I never got them donated or anything.
That's one of the things I'm always fascinated to hear, because I've talked to so many veterans of this era who said during that Great Depression, they felt it. They knew it was hard times. And others, depending on where they lived and what their situation was, they didn't realize how hard some other people had it. Did you see some evidence that this is not the way it's supposed to be, that these are definitely hard economic times?
No, I just thought it was one of those things that we just handled. And my dad was a carpenter there, and he worked too. My mom, she took care of all us kids. Every morning, they got us up. We didn't get to sleep in either. You had to get up, and I remember my two brothers are much younger than me. Regardless how cold it was outside, you just put some jackets on them and everything and put them outside there and play, not in the house. That's how it was, and we worked together.
I'm always curious, if you had a dream, an idea, an ambition as a child, hey, that someday when I grow up, here's what Al is going to do.
Well, I was kind of interested in airplanes or mechanics or something like that. And I thought, well, maybe one of these days. And later on, when I got this far, went in the Navy, I bought an old Model T car. I lived from the ranches. We moved into town because my dad was a carpenter there. So I bought an old Model T for $5 as a pickup. And we worked together, and another guy, my neighbor, had one too, and we were kind of hopping them up to get some power out of them, and I had parts laying around in the backyard, and it didn't look too good, but that's how I started working on mechanic stuff. We got it going, and sometimes we get in a neighborhood at that time, there was a strict on driving and so forth, a bunch of us kids would get together and had a bed on, and we'd push it and get it going, and we'd ride around the neighborhood. But a little lucky, we never got a ticket, I'll tell you.
I wonder what you could get for $5 today.
Not too much.
So, did you go to Dinuba High School?
Yes, uh-huh. I went 2 years there to Dinuba High School. You had 2 years, and you were 17 years old. And at that time, you could join the Navy. Well, this one guy and I used to hang around together. We used to get jobs, and then we used to deliver handbills for the theater there. And it was a little small town there. And he gave me a free ticket to the movie. Can you imagine? Instead of money. But anyway, he wanted to get in the Navy so bad. And I said, okay. I think at that time, I had finally got my driver's license early, but I don't remember how we got to Visalia. But anyway, that's where the recruiting office, they don't have them on every corner like they do now. And so we got down there and we took a test, and both of us passed. And then the recruiting guy, well, being 17, he had to come out to the house there and have my folks sign for me to go in. So they did. And then about a month later, or a week, a couple of weeks later, the recruiter come by and says, okay, you guys, get your gear together. We're going to ship you to San Francisco for a physical examination. Why you ever ship you up there when you're going to go down to San Diego? I never know. But anyway, we get up there, and boy, he was really gung-ho, man. We're going in the Navy. Yeah, right, wrong. We get the physical, and lo and behold, they passed me, but they didn't pass him because he was colorblind. Can you imagine? At that time. Anyway, I stayed in, and here I go on down there. And they had a group of us. We got on a train, and we rode it down to San Diego. So that's where I went, trained there for about 6 weeks.
And this is July of 41?
Yeah, uh-huh.
So you kind of got suckered into the Navy.
Yeah. Yeah, you might say that, yeah.
How did your folks feel about it? They had to sign for you.
Well, they thought I wasn't going to make it. But I did. Well, my dad was in the Navy, too. He was in the World War One, and he was a coxswain on a hospital ship. Now, he never did get much information on him like you have nowadays. So that's one reason I stayed in there.
A couple more things about before you went in the Navy. Those 2 years you spent at Dinuba High School, you remember what their mascot is?
Yeah, Emperors. Yeah, right. Yeah, Emperors, yeah.
Well, that's a little ironic given who you'd be fighting against not long after you left Dinuba High School.
Yeah.
The Emperor of Japan was not a Dinuba Emperor. The other thing I'm curious about, because of that part of the San Joaquin Valley and what happened during this time period, I imagine those years you went to school, you must have had some Japanese-American classmates, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I had some good fellows. I was in scouting before I went into the service a few years before. And we had the Japanese people in our troop and that. We all got along. We didn't at that time. We didn't even think about it, to be truthful.
Well, and I've talked to a lot of folks who were here in California when Pearl Harbor happened, and they saw, and I've talked to a lot of the Nisei veterans who were here, and how that happened for them and how they were forced out of their homes and sent to the internment camps. But you're already in the Navy. Were you getting wind of that from where you were?
No, I didn't even know anything about it, no.
Until afterwards, huh?
Yeah.
So let's focus on your experience then. You go in July of 41. Did you have any inkling that a war might be imminent?
At the time when I first went in, I didn't, no. After boot camp, you know, a lot of this, they had rifle manual of arms and so forth and semaphore. Well, I knew all that stuff because when I was in Danube, we had a ROTC program there, and they had to learn all that, which I joined, and I knew the manual of arms and how to march and everything. And then in scouting, we had semaphore. We didn't have all these fancy radios that they have nowadays. And in the Navy, I knew all the semaphore and everything, so I got by real easy, and tying knots and so forth. I knew all that stuff. That really prepared me for all the activities in boot camp.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do in the Navy, what your specialty would be, or what kind of ship you wanted to be on?
Well, no, I didn't know about the different ships at that time, but I wanted to be a mechanic for airplanes. That's what I wanted to do. So they gave us a bunch of tests. I guess my score wasn't quite high enough to go to school. So they signed me at that time. Afterwards, the boot camp, they signed me to the Enterprise. Well, the Enterprise was over in Pearl Harbor, so they said, okay, we're going to send about 10 of you guys are going to go down to San Pedro and get on this tanker. And this tanker was the Neosho. So he said, oh boy, it's going to take it 3 days to get over there. Well, you know the Navy, and 3 days, they ain't going to let you lay around. So what they do, they put a paintbrush in your hand and you start painting every day. And then when we got over there, they decided, well, the Enterprise outside, so they rounded us up, about 10 of us guys, and they put us on a motor launch, and lo and behold, they took us over, and it was put before the Enterprise came in, put us over and put us on one of these old battleships. They were all in port at that time. Of course, your sea bag was everything that you owned, including your mattress and everything. And that thing was so heavy, I think it weighed more than I did. And when I go clawing up those planks, I damn near lost mine. But anyway, they took us over, and they said, oh, okay, here's where you guys are going to sleep. They didn't have bunks like they did on the carrier. They slept in hammocks on this old battleship, and they lived out of your sea bag, and they had like a trough on it. And he said, okay, you guys, you put your sea bag here, and I'll show you where you hang your hammock. And he says, okay, Al, your hammock's going to be right here, and so forth. And he says, you take it down every day. And just about that time, some guy comes back and says, oh, no, you guys don't belong here. You got to go over to the Saratoga. Oh, boy, here we go again. You got to pack everything back up again. Back home and go through all that again. So they put us on a motor launch. We go over to Saratoga. We have to wait on the Saratoga until the Enterprise come in. Well, the Enterprise wasn't going to come in for a couple of days. So they put us on there, and here we got in a bunk that they had, and they put us to work again. And guess what we had to do? Well, at that time, the uniform of the day was T-shirts, white shorts, and socks, and black shoes. Well, we didn't have any, but they finally found some initiatives to it. So they said, that's what you wear during the day. And until you get transferred. Well, here again, what do you think they had us do? Paint. You know what we painted? The flight deck. Can you imagine? With a mop. Oh, I'll tell you. Never before. All right. And then finally the Enterprise comes in. And then they get us all together again, and then we get transferred to the Enterprise, and then they line us up on the hangar deck. You come up on the hangar deck, and they says, okay, I want you and you, and you're going to this division. They didn't ask you what you wanted to do or anything. You and you going here. And, oh, well, you know, he didn't luck out. He gets the deck division. He gets the ship's company in the deck division. And their duty was to take care of the forecastle and officer company and so forth. Well, that was okay. But, you know, when I went aboard there, you know, I never knew there were so many different bugle calls. Every 5 minutes, the old bugle will go and the old bosun will say, now hear this, so and so and so. And anyway, part of the seaman's job was, too, that they had to have the motor launch. Well, he gets assigned to a motor launch, but I don't remember a motor launch bugle call or like that. And they said away so many motor launch or boat and so forth. I never did hear mine, and I'm just kind of waiting around. And also, now hear this, Seaman Blumer report to the quarter deck. I'm in problem. I come to find out they had it, but I didn't know it. The other part of the crew kind of filled in on for me, and they come by the gangplank there. Okay, the old officer of deck says, I'll say, is that Blumer? He says, don't you know what your call is? And I says, no. He said, well, by God, you better learn it. He said, if you can't remember it, sleep in the damn motor launch. And I said, okay, very good, sir. Then I get my duty. But I mean, there are little things when you first go in, I'll tell you. Everything's so much noise, and aboard the ship I was on. And, you know, you have flight quarters, general quarters, then you got the motor launch, and you got the captain's gig, and you got the admiral's gig, and so forth. And each one is different, bugle, and fire drill, and general quarters. Of course, you always know general quarters. You never forget that.
And I imagine there's a few veterans in this room who are identifying with some of those stories that you shared, right? Especially you Navy guys. Hey, but I've got to ask you, Al, before I forget, and maybe you were coming to this anyway. They're moving you from this tanker, the Neosho, to a battleship. You didn't tell us the name of the battleship. And then to another carrier, the Saratoga, before you end up on the Enterprise. And we're going to hear about everything the Enterprise went through. But I'm sure you're aware of what went on those other ships that you almost ended up on.
Oh, yeah, well, Pearl Harbor, I really don't remember. It was kind of in the center. I don't remember which battleship it was
on. Which battleship?
Yeah, it was in the center more of Tennessee or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which had heavy damage there, too.
Oh, yeah, they all did. I could kind of pick it up, had a picture, but I don't have anything with me yet.
Well, wasn't the Neosho the one that got blown up?
The Neosho down there in the Battle of the Coral Sea, it got sunk down there. They refueled the Lexington and the Yorktown. Then that left the task force with one destroyer for protection, and the Japanese caught them by themselves there, and they sunk them both, and the Neosho too. But anyway, that was another. That's one we missed, but that's about the only one I can remember.
Well, and good thing you weren't on the Neosho. Good thing for you. But on the Big E, so you're finally part of that ship's crew, and you told us about some of the fun things you got to do on that giant aircraft carrier. What were you guys doing in the days leading up to December 7th, 1941?
Well, the ship's company, before December, we'd always go out to sea there, and then we'd qualify pilots, and then we'd come back in for a couple of days and get some liberty. Anyway, before the war, we took those Marine fighters to Wake Island, those 16 Marine fighters to Wake Island. Well, you know, Admiral Hosley was on our ship there, had put out a letter saying that we were under war conditions. He brought up all ammunition up into the guns. We were all prepared for war. The airplanes were all armed. Bombers had bombs on them and everything. They didn't put torpedoes on the torpedo planes until they actually found the enemy. However, we never did. We got within a few 100 miles or so of the Wake Island, and we launched all the 16 fighters. Well, the Marines, the pilots, were not too familiar flying at sea there with no recognition of land spots or anything, so they sent a couple SPDs with them to escort them to Wake Island. And then the SPDs, of course, wartime, we waited for them to come back. They were stationed there when the Japanese attacked it. Then on the way back, after we was ready to go into Pearl there, before we got there, we hit a part of a storm. We hit the storm, so that would make, and we had to refuel the destroyers because the old Admiral Osley, he was a captain of a destroyer, and he knew how rough it was for the sailors on him, so he made us a day late.
Well, and that would turn out to be a good thing for the Enterprise and for the Navy that the Enterprise was late getting back to Pearl Harbor. I mean, if that storm hadn't hit.
Right, yes, otherwise we'd have been, I don't know. might not have been here.
Well, we're thankful that he is here. And in fact, it wasn't too long ago that Al was honored by American Legion Post 147 in Clovis, California for 75 years of continuous Legion membership. He's also been recognized for more than 75 years of scouting, and both of those are ongoing. You can tell Al's memories are still crystal clear. So what does he remember about coming into Pearl Harbor after the infamous attack? What about the Doolittle Raid and the Battle of Midway? There's much more to come with one of our last living links to the aircraft carrier that was involved in more major actions against the Japanese than any other ship in World War II, the USS Enterprise. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. And close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Al Bloomer, 96 years old, of Fresno, California. It is not the first time his World War II service has been discussed on the airwaves. You'll notice it sounds a little scratchy, but Al still has a 78 RPM phonograph copy of a broadcast on KCOK radio welcoming him home after the war and describing some of his exploits.
He was on one of the Navy's largest aircraft carriers, the USS Enterprise. His ship was due in Pearl Harbor that day, but was delayed by storms at sea.
If you'd like to hear that entire recording, it's included on the podcast edition of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. But let's pick up the story right there on December 7th, 1941, with 18-year-old Al Bloomer and the first ship to be awarded a presidential unit citation, the Big E.
And when we got in about 100 or so miles out from Pearl Harbor, we launched aircraft to go into Pearl Harbor and make arrangements for tie up the ship and that. Of course, we had the inner air patrol going all the time during that period of time. We was prepared for war while we was out, but you know, in peacetime, you had to put the ammunition all down below when you go in the port and that for some unknown reason. But that is the only time after the war started we never did. We launched them, and then we finally got word that the Japanese was attacking Pearl Harbor. Well, lo and behold, then that started it, and we had to bring up all ammunition again, and we was ready for war when we got the notice. It sure changed the life on the ship, I'll tell you that. We launched those aircraft, and when they got in there, they attacked those SBDs and so forth, and they shot down a couple of them, and one of them, the guy survived on it. Gonzalez was his name. It's another story. We stayed at general quarters that whole day, prepared for war. During that period I was on the Enterprise, I was a trainer on a 5-inch 38 gun. That gun would shoot a projectile, weighed about 52 pounds, 10 miles. The powder case weighs about 25 pounds. It's a semi-fixed ammunition. And on this gun, it takes 8 people to man it. And that's not counting your shell carriers and your powder carriers that come out from below to put it on the different positions on the gun. Now, the Enterprise thought that they knew where the Japanese was when they were attacking it, and then we launched all aircraft. But lo and behold, they never found them. So they had to return, and a lot of them came in and it was still kind of dark, and they had to land by at nighttime. Well, most of them on board there was kind of experienced at doing that because the Navy knew that was coming. And also they, lots of those old TBS, and those were the old torpedo planes. I think they only could do about 150 miles an hour. And then they had that torpedo that hung down below underneath them. They finally landed them with them on, and this is the first time that this ever happened. So that was an experience in itself because they didn't know if they'd fall off or what. They'd go, you know. But anyway, we got everything aboard. We secured for jail quarters after dark. And one thing, too, after that, when we was on at sea during the war, that you'd go to general quarters an hour before sunrise and an hour after the sunset every day. I don't care if it's a holiday or what it is. And a lot of times you go and you can get condition two or four or so forth. The people that had the 12 to 4 watch would usually stay right on till after general quarters, because if you try to go to your bunk for an hour, it's kind of useless. So we just stayed up and did our duty and stayed and let the other guy sleep in until general quarters sounded.
How was an 18-year-old kid from Dinuba handling all of this? That sounds like a pretty long day with a lot of things you'd never experienced before.
I thought it was just part of the duty. You did it. If you didn't have the duty or someplace, and if you didn't have a working party or something like that, well, you'd find a corner. Maybe you could catch a couple sleeping periods there.
What about when you learned, when you were made aware of the magnitude of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the amount of damage that had been inflicted?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. We came in there the next day around 4 o'clock, and we come up the channel there, and of course, you know, I think it was the Nevada, the only one that the battleships that got underway there. He got halfway out the channel, and then they was bombing it, and they knew they wasn't going to make it out, so they backed that thing up and beached it so it wouldn't plug up the counter. And it was started smoking when we came in. And as we came up through the channel there, they had the gun emplacements they built. And the guy says, "Where in the hell have you guys been?" And they all made us number one, you know. They were mad at us because we didn't help them. Well, we did what we could do, but they never knew. So we went in and we pulled around. We went around and I seen all those battleships burning. And some of them were still burning and smoking. And they Oklahoma upside down. And then, of course, you seen the Arizona. It was bent over part of the superstructure and that before they took it all off and everything. But anyway, it was a mess. And, of course, you know, one of the destroyers that was in the dry dock across there, the bomb hit the bow of it and blew it off. I did know the name, but I can't remember it right now. And
the Shaw, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was the Shaw. Yeah, right. Yeah, we tied up ahead of where the pier was, and then a tanker pulled up alongside of us, and they pumped us full of oil and gas and everything that we needed. At that time, too, we was under condition, too. We had the guns manned all night because we never knew if they were coming in or not. And about 4 o'clock that next morning, we got underway again because we didn't want to get caught. We didn't know if there was going to make another strike or not the next day like that. So we went outside there and did some patrol work. We heard rumors that some guy says, "Hey, a carrier come in there." So they go out there and look, and there ain't no carrier in here. What are you guys talking about? And so they finally nicknamed us the Galloping Ghost of the Wahoo Coast Carrier. So we thought that was funny. But anyway, we cruised back there, and some of the different ships that got out, they joined up with us and everything to make a task force. In those days, the task force wasn't as big as they were later on in the war. I remember before we started making raids or battles, that usually we had a couple heavy cruisers and some destroyers with us. And there's about 6 of destroyers and a cruiser. After we got kind of organized and we made a couple raids, we went and raided Wake Island. And what we would do, try to sneak in on them. And then we would, early in that morning, when we was in so many miles of it, we'd launch all our aircraft to make a raid on them, and then we'd turn around and run off, and they had to catch up. Well, we didn't lose hardly any aircraft. I don't think that one we didn't lose any. And then we started to come back here, and we got orders, "Well, while you guys are out there, why don't you go down there and hit Marcus Island?" And it was about 1,000 miles, I think. It was only from Japan. I said, "My God." So we go down there and sneak in on them, and here again, we'd be launching all our aircraft again. And as soon as we'd launch those aircraft, we'd get the hell out of there. And they had to catch up to you. I think that raid, we only lost one. But that was kind of our tactic. And then we'd go back to Pearl and get ready for our next one.
And what were you doing this whole time?
Well, first of all, in the deck division, in peacetime, they put me in washing the officers' quarters. And I said, I ain't going to do this all day long. And had inspection, that guy come by with the white gloves and see if he could find a little dust there so he could put you on a report or something, you know. And then they said, well, we need a gunner strike. Anybody want? I raised my hand. I do. I want to get out of that. So I got assigned to take care of that 5-inch I was on and make sure it works, and you shine it up, and then you'd clean the different joints and everything so they wouldn't get rusty. And, you know, you kind of horse around a little bit. You didn't work hard, but, you know, that was part of your duty. For general quarters, you know, I was a trainer on it. Being a trainer on it, I got out of a lot of duty. In fact, I never did have to do mess duty at all. They did get some old guy, as kind of a goofball old guy, and put him on that. But anyway, I had a pretty easy, be truthful with you guys on it. The only thing is, you're going to get in trouble one of these days. Not that trouble, but I mean in war.
And the Enterprise would have plenty of that. I'm curious, though, when you say you were the trainer on that 5-inch 38, how often would you have to perform that duty? How often were those guns firing?
Well, mostly target practice are only on when you're under attack. When they put me, the first time I was on a trainer on that thing, we practiced there, and they said, yeah, you get on there and look at those sights there. We're going to put it on their director. I put my eye down there looking at it. Ooh, my God, that thing hit me in the eye there. And I said, like somebody socked me. I said, why in the hell didn't you guys tell me to keep your eye about an inch away from that? Well, I learned the hard way.
I guess so. And you said, you know, action would be coming for the Enterprise. And a few months after Pearl Harbor, about 5 months, you guys were headed toward Tokyo alongside the USS Hornet.
Uh-huh. Well, we went into Pearl there. We was out training or something, you know. The carrier, we never did get to stay in Pearl Harbor very long, like some of these guys on these destroyers. Why, they would send a squadron out with you. And then when they come back in, well, they'd sign you another one. And those guys, they get to have all the good liberty and everything. And we didn't get but one day, and then we're back at sea, either training or doing something. We no peace on the carrier at that time. And then they said, okay, prepare to get underway. And we just said, well, we just came in again. And so out to sea we go. And we didn't know where we was going. And we was out there about the second day. And here come the Hornet with a whole bunch of B-25s on the flight deck. And we said, where in the hell are we going to go with them? How are they going to get off? We never dreamed that they were going to launch it from that carrier. But anyway, we kept going, and then the old admiral comes on to the public speaking system. He tells us what we're going to do. He says, we're going to go in within 500 miles of Japan, and we're going to launch these B-25s. And we said, boy. And when we started the day that we was going to launch those things, it was got rough. We was doing up and down and so forth. But the day before, that it was so rough, that they decided to leave the destroyers back because they could not keep up with the larger ships going to make a run in to launch those aircraft. And so the smallest ship we had was the light cruiser, and they had the 6-inch guns on it. That's the older style ones. They didn't have the brand new ones like they had now. Anyway, we get there, and about 10 o'clock in the morning or something, I hear gun firing. And then I hear general quarters, and I said, oh, we're in trouble now. But anyway, that's when they run into these sampans about 650 miles outside of Japan. That light cruiser was shooting them. The dive bombers were trying to bomb them, and the old fighters were trying to strafe them so they wouldn't get the message off. And then pretty soon you ran into another one. I said, oh, boy. And here goes the same old routine again. So they decide to launch the aircraft. Was going to launch them, and the guy's on the gun group, he says, I'll bet you $20 they don't make it. Yeah, I'll take $5 of that. you know, and then the guy down along gambling at that. You know, there's no gambling on Navy ships. But anyway, that's the way it goes. And we watched them, and they decide to launch. We watched them, and that old Hornet would go up when it hit those waves, goes down. And what they would try to do on the up side, they timed it where the B-25s would take off. And then lo and behold, the first one, of course, was Doolittle himself, and he's a good pilot, man. He roared that thing up, and you could almost see it. And then it moved like that, and it went right on off. And then one of them didn't put his flaps out or something. And we said, uh-oh, he's going in. He's going way down. They couldn't even see him. And we couldn't see him either because the ship. And then all of a sudden, he appeared back up again. Every one of them. And I read where it took an hour and 1 minute to launch all those 16 B-25s off of that carrier. And then after that, boy, you know, we turned around and we got out of there as fast as we could. Well, I heard rumors. I don't know how true it is, but I heard they thought we wasn't going to be able to launch aircraft. They were thinking that we was going to launch our own aircraft, and they had to begin about 100 or 200 miles before you get to Japan, and they were setting up a trap for us. They never dreamed that it was going to be those B-25. But anyway, we got out of there, and we all survived.
And you had the best seat in the house, it sounds like. I mean, this is something that's never, ever happened before in history that a lot of people said was impossible. You guys on your ship are betting they're not going to get off the deck of that Hornet. And you sat there and watched all 16 of those B-25s take off?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I stood on the starboard side there, and I could stand on my 5-inch gun up there, and I could look over there and see them, watch them. They all take off.
When you're watching that, are you wondering what's going to happen to them?
Yeah, I sure did. Of course, I never knew until afterwards. They never told us. And you know, too, on the way back there, that task force, they said, now listen, this is a secret. And they said, if any of you guys say anything about where those B-25s come from, you're going to be put in prison, and you're going to be making big rocks at the little ones the rest of your life. So I want you, and you believe it or not, I never did hear of anybody that told where those came from during my whole time during the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the Navy, until after it was really publicized. And the fact, too, that you didn't even get it put on your record at that time. You never got credit for it. But anyway, things got straightened up later on.
And maybe you remember, maybe you don't. Did it occur to you guys at the time, as you're watching this, that there's no way those guys can return to the carrier, that this is a one-way mission for them?
Yeah, they told us that they were going to go to China there. They got a place where they was going to land. Of course, they never told us all the trouble they're going to have before they got there. But that comes on later.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there would be plenty of trouble in store for the Big E as well. I know you guys went back into Pearl Harbor, but it wasn't long after that, a month or so later, that the Battle of Midway unfolds, and the Enterprise played a crucial role in the Battle of Midway.
Yeah. Before we get to that battle, we made a raid. I want to tell you about the raid on the Marcus and Gilbert Islands. The Hornet was with us, and the Hornet took part of Inuit Talk, and we took Kwajalein Island there, and we raided them. This was our first time that we ever did this. We started off early in the morning launching aircraft, and they'd go in, and they held the torpedo plane back, and if they found some ships in the harbor while they launched them, which they did, and some of those started real 5 o'clock in the morning, they launched an aircraft and bombers and fighters and so forth. After they got that raid going and everything, they found some ships in the harbor, so they took the torpedo planes. And some of those torpedo planes, pilots were mad because of when they launched the torpedo planes, they hit the ship, but they never exploded. So that was a problem with it. But anyway, that went on all day long until about 4 o'clock. We tried and brought some aircraft back and refueled them, and they made another run. So they decided we had everything pretty well under control because they worked over the airfields and forth like that. We secured from general quarters and went to condition 2, which means half the crew was on the guns, half there, and the other half, they decided to have lunch. And so they relieved them like that. Lo and behold, about an hour later, on the starboard side that I was on, we looked up, and here comes those six 20-inch bombers heading right for us. And I said, oh, my God. We ran up there and we jumped. And we, you know, those things, you didn't have those earphones. All we had was cotton we put in our ears. Well, we didn't have any, didn't get the cotton in my ears. And we got two shots off at them. Before they hit us, I mean, they released their bombs, and I said, oh, my God. I thought we were raised in for it. But anyway, they kind of straddled and started a fire on the port side. One of the bombers, he wanted to really get us. He turned around, and he was going to kamikaze the flight deck there. Well, they were shooting at him. There was a SBD sitting on the starboard side there, right by the edge, and he came by, and his wing crashing into the side of the ship there, his wing hit, tore that tail section off of the that SBD where that gunner was shooting at him, and went over the side there, started a little fire, and put some holes in the side of the ship and that. But anyway, you could see that in that new movie come out.
I was just going to say, that scene is depicted very powerfully in that movie. So what you saw on the big screen sounds like what you saw in real life?
Yeah, right, yeah.
I imagine that had to be a little surreal. I know we've been focused on your story, but since you brought up the movie, that latest Midway movie, was that surreal to see these events that you lived captured in that kind of fashion on the big screen?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Did they miss anything? Did they leave anything out or take any liberties?
I talked to Janice, you know, in the movie they showed them the Japanese were flying down between the battleships. Well, no way. They were close together. You know, that was reproduced anyway. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't do that. Yeah, there's some other spots there, but, you know, that's a movie for you, but there's a lot of real scenes in it.
That new Midway movie is out on video now. Whether you've already seen it or you're going to after hearing Al's story, you can compare what you see on the screen to what you're going to hear from Al when we come back. How did an 18-year-old sailor from Dinuba, California, experience that pivotal World War II battle in the Pacific? We'll find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chance to visit with 96-year-old Al Bloomer of Fresno, California. He enlisted in the Navy at age 17 before the U.S. was drawn into World War II, and he's already shared some of the historic moments he was a part of on the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. I can't believe it's taken us this long to get to the Battle of Midway, that pivotal battle in June of 1942 that in so many ways turned the tide in the war in the Pacific.
Well, we were trying to surprise them. You know, we sent out our scout planes to look for the Japanese. We were trying to find them before they launched the attack on Midway. Well, you know, you launch them and recover them, and you launch them again and everything. But anyway, this one time, we launched aircraft. They were flying in, and they thought they knew where they were. They found some of those carriers, in which the story is that we bombed them. Yet our Enterprise, the two scout planes found them, and those two pilots, they put a couple of bombs on one carrier that really started the fire going on and it burned. So that put one out of commission, and then the other ones came out later. They finally knew where we were at, and then, so they sent torpedo planes and dive bombers to get this carrier. Well, the carrier was the Yorktown. It was a sister ship to us, built exactly the same. It just got back from the Coral Sea, and they put it together as best they could, and they put it to sea because they would need the aircraft to help repel the Japanese. Well, the Yorktown came by us a day later, and they were over there by on the horizon by themselves. Our task force was a Hornet, and the Enterprise was in another one, and we could see them over there, and they found the Yorktown first. They never did see us. We watched them attack the Yorktown and make runs on it. They were, looked like they were just small toys, about an inch big. We watched them fly in, and we sent our fighters over to help them. And, of course, they got a couple hits on it. They got a torpedo hit on it. But the whole battle is that they never did find the Hornet or us. Well, anyway, they got the Yorktown going again. Well, they sent out another raid to get the other carriers. Since the Yorktown was underway, they thought it was another carrier. So they attacked it again, and it happened to be the same one. Here again, we lucked out again. They didn't bother us. They never did see us during that battle. We got credit for it, but our pilots did all the work.
But you're also seeing this, and I'm listening as you describe that. So you're, again, I mean, you had this perfect view of the Hornet launching the B-25s and the Doolittle raid, and now you're watching in the Battle of Midway the one American carrier that was sunk there getting peppered by the Japanese.
Right.
And you know that there are sailors just like you on that ship. Was that hard to watch? Does that disturb you?
Well, it kind of makes you mad, but, you know, what are you going to do? You got your job to do, and that's it. That's the way it goes.
We know now the significance of the Battle of Midway and what it meant in the bigger picture of the war. Was that evident to you guys when you left that battle, or when did you realize what a big deal that was going
to
be?
We didn't think anything about it, to be truthful. It's just one of those battles, you know, you're in, and that's it. Never even thought of nothing about it. You know, you just do it, that's it.
So there at Midway, you lose the Yorktown. A few months later, I guess, what would that be, 4 months later, the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands, you're going to lose the Hornet. And you guys were hit by a couple bombs there at the Santa Cruz Islands, right?
Yeah, well, for Santa Cruz, the Battle of Guadalcanal was first, and then the Battle of Santa Cruz come up. Guadalcanal, that was the first big one. We was down there. We launched aircraft, as we do. During the whole time that we were down there, that's when they invaded it. And we just cruised back and forth, launch aircraft, rigs, cover them, and do it like that. And about the next day or two, okay, here they come. They bring their carriers down, and we're going to have a big old battle. We were attacked about, well, probably 50 or more planes, dive bombers and so forth. You know, in those days, why they have that, we had like a bed spring up there for radar. Then we had some water-cooled 50s, but finally we got them changed. It took enough time to put some 20s on, but we still had the old 1.1s for that battle. We didn't have the 40s yet. It started off there, and here they come, and they come in forward. If they come in forward, they release the bomb. They're going to hit in the after part of your ship. Well, they were coming in forward, so we knew there was going to hit the after end of the ship, the stern. And the first two bombs came, and they went down about the third or fourth deck, and one exploded. And then another one, it hit that powder case there on that 5-inch battery back there and blew the whole battery up and the whole explosion. And it put all those guns out of commission, and I think it killed about, oh, around 35, 40 guys. Because remember I'm telling you about how many takes each gun there? That's how many got killed. And it kind of warped the old flight deck up in a kind of like a humbleback. We finally got going on that. And after that, we survived. We never got any torpedo hits. We still could operate for a while. Then pretty soon they told us to go back to Pearl there, get the replacement and everything. Well, that took a little while. After a battle, we always have to go into number one dry dock to repair the near misses with blows in part of your ship, hull, and that for leaks. They never take the ammunition off like they did peacetime. Everything's on there. And then we pull in this time, and they put those old logs against so you don't fall over, you know. And then he says, okay, now hear this, hear this. All ships, company crew, regardless of rates, are going to scrape the side of the ship. God dang, did you ever see how far from the main deck to the bottom of it on that little old 2x4? That's what it seems like. But anyway, that plane. And so we scraped that thing, and I was scared bad. I didn't want to use the word. But anyway, so we got it all done around 3:30 or so forth that day. And we was up there, and lo and behold, I went in, took a shower, and was coming around. And pretty soon I hear, fire drill. I said, a fire drill? I haven't been to a damn fire drill in a year. I don't even know where my station is. Here at old Bunhope Force Division up on the floor, forecastle, wanted to know where their fire station is. Nobody knew where the fire station was. So here I go, and I said, okay, I'm going to go down to the hangar deck and see what's coming. I go down a ladder down, just about two decks down, and go down there, and I look over the side, and I see flames coming up. And I said, my God, what's going to happen? I said, this is a hell of a way to go. I said, here you did, battling a damn dry dock. And then some guy, sailor, walks by me. He says, oh, hell, that ain't bad there. He says, you should see back aft. If I see flames here, what am I going to see back there? Anyway, they got it put out, but we didn't have to redo the job. I guess they got the ship's company. But that was really an experience.
What started the fire? Where did it come from?
Oh, I don't know. One of the yard workers like that had a flame or something and caught a fire. I never knew. I never even worried about where it came from. I just, it got it out, that's all.
So then October 42, Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands?
Okay, we got repaired. Well, we got those new 40 millimeters. You know, those quad mounts. They could shoot 500 rounds per minute, and they put those on to replace the old 1.1s. We thought, well, it was good, and then we had this, the all-new 20s. They added some on, put a whole row of them alongside of the flight deck, the side of the superstructure. On the side there, we used to stack up those boats. Okay, we're getting ready, and the old officer in charge of the flight deck said, get all those planes off that flight deck. Get them off. Well, there's someone with an armed refuse. I don't give a damn. Get them off that flight deck. We don't want no aircraft on that flight deck starting fires and that. Pretty soon we get a report, oh, they're 100 miles out coming. And then here again, they go, oh, 75 miles out coming in, getting 50 miles. Then they give us a position. And here I am on this 5-inch, and they're kind of coming in the stern. So I'm bringing the old 5-inch gun around like that, and I look up, and here they come right at me. First two releases of the bomb, and they were headed straight for me. And I said, oh, dear old Al, you're not getting out of this one. This is it. There ain't no way that you're going to live through this one. Those two bombs come down, and they just barely missed the splinter shield. They exploded. That raised that old bow up and shook it, and the water knocked me out. The water came down and brought me back. Made me feel I was shaking. And then what I didn't know, there was two more dive bombers coming behind it. One came down, we went off between the two gun galleys by the number one elevator and exploded down in the third and fourth deck and just cleaned that all out. The next one went out the side of the flight deck outside of the ship and exploded. That was the closest call I had the whole time I was on the Navy. The bow was taking on water down there where the percussion pushed in part of the hull and it was leaking, and they were trying to get it under control. But we still launched the aircraft and everything and repeat them, but we couldn't use our number one elevator. We were stacked by 83 aircraft that lasted 55 minutes, and they launched 10 torpedoes at us, and we dodged them all. That ship could turn on a dime. As big as it was, it could really turn. Let me tell you.
Well, it's a good thing, or else you wouldn't be here. And it sounds like you almost weren't here. First, I'll help us understand, when you're sitting in that trainer position, what's around you? Are you sitting in a chair with your eyes on this scope, or what do you...
They can put open sights on them.
Okay.
Yeah, the director can't move fast enough to get dive bombers or anything.
Uh-huh.
It's just open sights deal. And you just shoot the hope the hell that you hit something.
I'm just wondering, so just physically, as you're sitting there, what's around you?
Well, the first is a gun here, mm-hmm. and then right there is the sight of it, right beside you is where it's part of the gun mount.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And the sight setter, he's behind me up here. He stands up and works the sights for the gun on my side. And the pointer is on the other side. He's the one that fires it.
Right.
And they got the loader and the shelter on that side, too, and they load it.
So you're all in this together, and you see these bombs coming, what it feels like is right at you. And then you were actually knocked unconscious?
Well, yeah, I was out there. I didn't know anything until the water hit me. I guess so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this water splashes all the way up to where you are.
Yeah, it comes down.
Covers you.
Yeah, it's going out. like that and comes down. The side of the ship comes that kind of out like that, and we just kind of like in a hole there. Yeah, but the gun sits out where they open. This air, also at the same time, it was kind of cloudy that day, too. And this one time, this dive bomber looked over at him, and here he's diving at the South Dakota was on our starboard side, real close to you. He released his bomb, and I seen him hit the number two turret and explode. It bounced off, exploded, and killed some guys on the bridge in that, on the South Dakota.
Well, and on your ship in that battle of the Santa Cruz Islands, I believe I read about 44 men were killed.
Oh, yeah.
And then the same battle, the Hornet is sunk, and you guys end up picking up a lot of their survivors, right?
Oh, well, they transferred them. We didn't pick them up. They transferred some of them to us, replaced the ones that got killed on our ship. Yeah.
And another thing I read once about your ship, and I don't know if you saw it or if you heard about it, but because now in the Pacific, you know, the Yorktown was sunk at Midway. Now the Hornet is sunk in this battle. The Enterprise is the only carrier left in the Pacific. And I heard someone put a sign on your ship that said, Enterprise versus Japan.
You're right, yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah, they showed it to us. After the Santa Cruz there, you know, there's a lot of happened there. They detached the battleships from us, and they went down there and doodled it out down there at Guadalcanal there. And of course, they thought that they all conquered, I mean, all destroyed and that. And then they relieved us. We went back to New Caledonia there to a repair ship there, trying to see if they could get the elevator working and patch up some of the holes that they could get reached to. The battleships, they went down there and had that big duel with the other, and they sunk one battleship down there, and the South Dakota and the Washington was in it too, and then they depatched the ones that the AA cruiser, 5-inch cruiser, that the Sullivan brothers was on down there with them. All they were supposed to be is to protect us because of their thin hull, and that's when they all got killed down there. And so, you know, one of the things, too, that we had brothers on our ship there, and they said, we're going to transfer. And no two brothers can be on the ship at the same time.
After the five Sullivan brothers went down on the Juno?
Yes, that's right.
Well, I've got to ask you, Al, and I know this seems cliche, or maybe it's, you know, an obvious question, but I'm sure it's something that you considered at some point. When you're seeing all this happen around you, you're seeing these other massive carriers sunk, you know, guys off your own ship have died. How about you? Were you concerned that might happen to you? Were you afraid? What was your mindset?
Well, you know, before your battle, you get that kind of a nervous stomach before, because you know it can happen to you. But, you know, after you once get started firing and everything, you forget all that stuff. You just do what you got to do and fire your gun and hope the heck that you make it. I don't know how to explain it to be truthful, but you always wonder about it.
No ship can match the record of the Enterprise.
No.
Do you know how many times your ship was reported sunk by the enemy?
Oh, no, a lot of times, yeah. They thought they had us, yeah. You know, there's some ships that are unlucky and there's some that aren't, and that's part of it.
What are some of the other things that you look back on with pride about your ship or the men who served on your ship or things that you yourself were involved in?
I don't know. You know, at the time, you don't think too much about it. Really, I never talked too much about it when I was young after getting out of the Navy because, you know, you never talk about it and never say nothing. Like you say here, you never say anything to your kids about it until you get old. And then sometimes it finally comes around and comes out. I wish my dad would have told me more about what he did when he was in the Navy. Believe it or not, I still have his old bulletin pipe. I still have that from '01. Yeah, I showed it to the crew here. Yeah, I still have his.
Can you play anything on it?
No, I try. No, I have my good friend Wally. He plays it on it.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, you don't tell your kids about it, but something finally changed for you. What was it that convinced you that these were things you had to share, that you needed to get off your chest and people needed to know?
I think coming in this class was the biggest part of it. Mm-hmm. I really do. They don't want to really kind of get you going on anything. And hearing stories of other people. Yeah. Comradeship.
Well, Al, you're one of the last guys left that served on that ship. That was part of the Big E and its legendary exploits in World War II and all the close calls that you survived. I'm curious what's important to you that people know about your ship for you, for the guys you served with, for the impact that you had?
Well, it'll never be another one. It's going to be now a completely different type of war. Yeah, it's going to be completely different. I see these big carriers there, and I said, oh, boy, a couple of those rockets hit it, and there, that's it. But anyway, that's my opinion.
Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm still here.
Amen.
Yeah. Hopefully, a few more years yet.
Well, we will all be counting on that, as I know they are in your Monday morning Stories of Service class in Clovis, California, which will resume meeting once the coronavirus coast is clear. Thanks again to Janice Stevens, who has led that class for nearly two decades, for letting us drop in and interview Al in a comfortable environment for him. And thanks to his fellow veteran, Olin Gray, who twisted his arm and talked him into sharing his story here. There are a few more memories that Al shared that we couldn't quite fit into our radio time today, but you can find those in the extended podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thank you so much for listening to the program today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. I promise there would be more here on the podcast version, and you've been hearing some of it. I'm going to cue up that 75-year-old phonograph audio from KCOK Radio in a moment. And, of course, we're going to hear some more anecdotes from Al. But first, let's hear from Janice Stevens, who leads that weekly veterans class that has been so instrumental in Al's opening up about his Navy experiences. Once the coast is clear from coronavirus, that free Stories of Service class for veterans of all ages will once again meet every Monday morning at 9:30 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District in Clovis, California.
First of all, tell me about Al Bloomer and what he's meant to you and this group of veterans here.
Well, I learned probably more today than I have in all of the years that we've had him in class, because it was a continuous conversation of his experience, whereas other times it's a little bits and pieces and a commentary on something that's come through. So this was fabulous to hear this detailed from beginning to the out of the war to today.
But he's been pretty consistent here for a long time, right?
Every Monday morning for as long as I can remember.
And you've been doing this since 2002. Why? Why did you start, and why are you still doing it almost 20 years later?
That's interesting, isn't it? Huge love for these veterans and what they've done for us. I was asked to do this class by Tom Wright, who is chairman of the board for Clovis Veterans Memorial District, and he asked for an instructor who could get the veterans' stories. And out of that, we compiled two books of stories of service, and I've continued ever since.
How long are you going to keep this going?
As long as I can. I wonder that sometimes, too.
I know you wouldn't be doing it if you didn't see the results, if you didn't see what it meant to all these veterans to be able to get these stories off their chests.
Right.
But what have you gotten out of it? What's been the reward or the fulfillment for you?
Every Monday morning, it's a history lesson, and it's a personal history lesson. I see these people. I know these people. And then I know what they've experienced, and it's, it's a thrill. It's a thrill, and it's a huge, huge honor to be part of this.
I've so admired Janice's work and her heart for veterans for so, so long, and I know without her dedication and commitment, we would not have had the chance to hear Al's memories today. Here are a few more of those memories, followed by that radio broadcast from right after Al's return from the war.
Finally, they tried to make a history out of the Enterprise, you know, historic. But, you know, you couldn't do that because the requirements they have now, you know, the old days, but toilet was a trough-like with water running through. You probably heard of the story before. And you had just a piece of board here that you sat on, and maybe a little metal on each side. Well, you know, and then the showers, you didn't have no curtain or anything like that. All you had is a water head coming out of the wall. And the bulkhead, there, get it right. It got the bulkhead so far apart, and you just take your shower and don't even worry about the if somebody's in there or not. But, you know, there's no way they could ever do that. And when they scrapped it, that lo and behold, they kept part of the planks of the flight deck, and they sold those to the crews. And I do have a part of the flight deck at home. The souvenir shows it, and they put a sign on it that you couldn't sell it or anything like that.
I'm remembering right now interviewing a gentleman years ago from the Visalia area who was credited with saving the Enterprise because of a an apparatus he created to fight the fires, a rebreather.
Oh, so yeah, that's when that hit after when they blew up that gun gully. Right, yes. Yeah, we thought we had it.
Tell us about that situation, because as I remember, I think the ship was just doing circles and smoking up a storm, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they got the fire out and everything, and went down there, and where the engine, the electric engine was, evidently they had to have a cooling system hooked up by it to keep it cool, or otherwise it would burn up. It wasn't working. I guess it got so hot down there, they couldn't get anybody down there to get it unstuck or get the fans going. And we was kind of going in the circle. And then at one instant, why they came to a complete stop. And I said, oh, my God, we're going to get it now. But anyway, that day you pulled some of those guys out. You probably heard about it, yeah. And then they finally got it going. And we got going again. A couple of guys passed out for overheat. And get this guy, pull them back out. But anyway, they worked back there. That's about all I know about it, you know. Because all you do is sit there at your station. You don't. That's your job. That's somebody else's job to fix that and so forth. So, but you just hope that they don't catch you. After 2 years of war and that, they brought us back to update it. And I got transferred off to went to a crash boat. But anyway, that's just an aviation rescue boat. Mm-hmm. And all you did is you go down there and they put you assigned to an island there like a Kwajalein. We'd go out there in the airport there and they'd launch aircraft off of the island and then fade and crash while we'd pick up whatever survived. And that's it. But anyway, that's
about it. Did you ever
have
to do that?
Yeah, we went out and I was while I was on it. No, none crashed when I was on it. And then I got transferred off, and I went into charge of an armory on the island up there in Kwajalein. And then after that, they transferred me up to Inuitok. I got up there to Inuitok there, and they said, oh, what the hell are you doing here? You're a gunner's mate. We don't have no guns here. So they put me on getting the mail. So, we'll put you on the mail and make you in charge of a barracks. I said, okay. And that's all I did for a year or so. And I seen those destroyers come in there and half the top missing. I said, oh, my God, am I glad I'm here. But anyway, that's about it there.
Is that where you were when the Japanese surrendered?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
How'd you get that news, and what did that mean to you?
Oh, what a relief it was. And I felt good. And they said, if you got enough points, you can go home. Well, I had a lot of points because I never was home. I was home one time in 4 years.
What was the hardest thing? What was the most challenging or difficult thing you had to deal with over those 4 years?
Oh, I don't know. I kind of rolled with the punches. You know, I got along with everybody. I don't know. It's just part of your job. I mean, that's what you're in the Navy for.
And then you came back to California. What was it difficult to transition back to being a civilian after 4 years with all these sailors?
No, not too bad. No, not for me. No, it was just another job.
What'd you do?
Well, I did work wherever I could. I went and worked for the theater for a while. You know, I was kind of hanging around those, and I did work there. And then decided I wanted to go back to school, so I went back to Reedley College and graduated from there. And then I worked for J.C. Penney's, and then the manager says, why don't you go on our training program for theater? So I went on the training program for theater there. And then I was transferred, went up to Willis, California there. Of course, you know, there's no fertilizing with the employees, but that's where I met my wife. But anyway, then I became a manager. After that, I got transferred down to Modesto. And Modesto there, I was the manager of the Loma Theater for a couple of years. And I said, my God, this is no job for a married guy. Work all holidays and that. So there was an opening in the bank. So I started took an opportunity to work for the bank. And I worked for Crocker Bank there for 32 years. But that's it.
You kind of glossed over that there, Al. You said, no fraternizing with employees. But that's where I met my wife. Yeah, so you broke that rule or what?
Well, you know how it goes. You know, win a few, lose a few.
How'd that work out for you?
Oh, fine. Yeah, we was married over 63 years. She just passed away a year and a half ago. That's it. Ain't no more. Any questions?
Anybody got a question for Al?
You referred to the turning radius of the Enterprise. What engineering feature of the boat allowed it to turn so readily?
Well, I guess it had a big old rudder on it. And they had the four screws. It could turn. Oh, I could. No, I'm not. It's past Hollywalla time. I've told enough. I was going to tell you. You know, I'll tell you anyway. If you want to go home, go ahead. When I was a seaman, first class there in peacetime, one of the duties of the deck division was to send a seaman up there and learn how to be a helmsman and a talk on the phone. Well, you know. Oh, well, when he makes seaman, you know the first thing is going to happen. They're going to make him go up there. And you believe it or not, I was a helmsman on that ship and learned how to steer it and everything. There's a secret about it. When you get up there, the officer of the deck gives you a command. You don't give any command. You do what he says. And he says you give it a hard right rudder, you give it a hard right rudder. And that's it. And they're always zigzagging after the war. For a couple of a year there, they used to make us do it. But when you come with it, when you're a helmsman, when you swinging that stern around, well, you got to get a stop. And what you have to do when you come 15 degrees before your scheduled course, you got to meet it. What means you've got to swing that big old rudder opposite to stop that swing and come right on that course because you're in that whole task force and they all do it at the same time. And if you don't do it right, man, you're in trouble. I know one time some of the destroyers, a couple of them ran into another one, a ship in that. And then that was something.
Anything else you want to say, Al?
No, I'm just thankful I'm still here. Actually, you know, I enjoyed myself when I was on the Navy. When I first went in, boy, I tell you, I thought that was the biggest racket there ever was. Don't get me started again. I'm sorry. But anyway, when I went in there, you know, you work Monday, Tuesday, half a day Wednesday. Half a day Wednesday, you're supposed to do peacetime, I'm talking about. You have to do your laundry or whatever. And then you work Thursday, half a day Friday. And then if you didn't have the duty on for the weekend, you could go to shore. This is when you're in Pearl. I'm in the harbor, not at sea. When you go in Pearl, why, you can go ashore at noon and then they have to be back till 8 o'clock Monday morning. And I thought, oh, my Lord. And they hollered about chow. I thought the chow was good.
How about a hand for Al Bloomer, huh?
Jensen, your jeweler of Dinuba, presents Welcome Home. Welcome Home is a transcribed true life story of the returning veterans, men and women in your communities who have given months, even years of their lives for a better way of life. Welcome Home, brought to you by Jansen, your jeweler of Dinuba, tells you of the work, often dreary, sometimes spectacular, performed in the armed forces by those to whom we owe so much. Here now is a personal message from our sponsor, Mr. Jansen.
Welcome Home isn't a program to extol praises of war, but a program to let those just out of uniform know that we understand their sacrifices and feel humble in the sight of their deeds. Deeds that have given us peace and the knowledge that our way of life is safe again by their hands. So we devote this program to saying, it is good to see you again. We're glad you're home.
Thank you, Mr. Jansen, and today we're welcoming home Albert Fred Bloomer, son of Mr. and Mrs. Fred Bloomer of Dinuba. He enlisted in the United States Navy in July 1941 and received his troop training at San Diego and was then assigned to the fleet and went directly to Pearl Harbor. On that fateful morning of December 7th, he was on one of the Navy's largest aircraft carriers, the USS Enterprise. His ship was due in Pearl Harbor that day, but was delayed by storms at sea. This was not only fortunate for Bloomer, but his country as well, because the Enterprise was an important factor in turning the tide of no less than 10 major sea and air battles. He saw action as a gunner's mate at Midway and fights in the Solomon. In the Battle of Santa Cruz, the Japs sent 83 planes over the Enterprise to drop bombs. The ship was hit several times during engagements with the enemy, and when there was time, a little patching up would be done and the ship kept on the job. One of the historic missions of the Big Flat Top was accompanying the aircraft carrier Hornet within a few hundred miles of Tokyo to send General Doolittle and his flyers on their daring raid over the Japanese capital. In August of 1943, he was home for his first leave in 22 months. He returned to duty and went on to be a part of a unit that received the Presidential Citation for consistently outstanding performance and distinguished achievement, being repeated against enemy action in the Japanese forces in the Pacific War area. For participating in nearly every major carrier engagement in the first year of the war, the Enterprise and her air group, exclusive of her far-flung destruction of hostile shore installations throughout the battle area, did sink or damage on her own a total of 35 Japanese vessels and shoot down a total of 185 Japanese aircraft. Her aggressive fighting spirit and superb combat efficiency are fitting tribute to the officers and men who so gallantly established her as a solid bulwark in defense of the American nation. She participated in 8 major battles with the mighty carrier, including Guadalcanal and many other famous naval battles. She later took training for air sea rescue work and was attached to a Navy crash boat. 63 feet of the Navy's most terrific fighting power that pushes through the water at outstanding speed to pick up pilots and crews of fallen planes. The crash boats were indeed one of the units to which many are thankful. Rumor went on to the Hawaiian Islands and from there to the Marshall. His enlistment was up in August of 1944, and he was released shortly after the end of the war. He is now employed at the State Theater in Dinuba, and so to Albert Fred Bloomer, radio station KCOK, joins Jan Panugula of Dinuba in saying welcome home and thanks for a job well done. Jeweler of Dinuba will again welcome home another returning veteran Tuesday at this same time on this same station. In the meantime, Jansen, your jeweler of Dinuba, invites you to stop in and see one of the valley's finest selections of jewelry, watches, and gifts. Jansen's jewelry has always insisted upon the ultimate in craftsmanship and service. At Jansen, you can see the latest and greatest screw and precision watches. Yes, for treasured timepieces and enduring gifts, it's Jansen, your jeweler of Dinuba. Until Tuesday at this hour, when Jansen, your jeweler of Dinuba, returns to this station with a true story of another of our returning veterans, we bid you a very good evening.